The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Call of Mecca, is dedicated to the memory and Ilu Nishmos, Mr. and Mrs. Nathan and Bell Cohen, Aleihem HaShalom, of blessed memory.
Yeah. History is full of surprises. And probably the greatest surprise in all of history is that of the Arabs. An insignificant and almost unknown people, the Arabs exploded on the scene of history like fireworks on the 4th of July. In a matter of a few short years after the death of Muhammad in 632, the Arabs launched a blitzkrieg against the Persian-Byzantine empires, succeeded to create an empire that was greater than that of Rome at its zenith. From the Bay of Biscay in the west to the Indus River and the confines of China in the east, from the Aral Sea in the north to the lower cataracts of the Nile in the south, the name of Arabia's most famous native son, Muhammad, together with the name of Allah, the Almighty, was being called five times a day from thousands of minarets. Even today, after the fall of that empire, Islam, the religion that Muhammad founded, is adhered to from Morocco to Indonesia. Approximately 1 billion people, one out of every 6 human beings on this planet, is Muslim, and their numbers are increasing by approximately 25 million a year. Put that in perspective with the Jews, who only number some 14 million. Although the Arabs are no longer a world power, they still play an inordinate role in history in general, and Jewish history in particular. The story of the foundations of their empire and the religion that they created is the topic of tonight's lecture. To understand the dynamics of Arab history, we must first go back to its roots. The word Arab seems to be related to the word Arava, Araba, desert wilderness. Arabs are those that occupy the Araba. According to Arab tradition, the first Arabs were the descendants of Yoktan. If you have the handout on the first page, you see it says that Aver had two sons. The first name was Peleg, who was the ancestor of the Jews. His brother's name was Yoktan. Yoktan, or Kachton as he is known in Arabic, was the founder of the southern Arabs of Yemen, or Yaman. And again, as we see, and from the next paragraph, paragraph B in section 1, that Arabs, nomads who traveled the Arabah, traveled the desert, existed in the time of Avram Avinu, of Abraham, way before Yishmael. The father of the northern Arabs, according to Arabian tradition, was Adnan. According to Arab genealogists, Adnan was a descendant of Yishmael, the son of Avraham, or as he is known in Arabic, Ibrahim. Adnan had a descendant by the name of Qais. The descendants of Qais so overshadowed the other northern tribes that in much of the Arab world, the northern Arabs as a group were called Qais. The rivalry between the northern Arabs and the southern Arabs that has played such a great role in Arab history is known as the struggle between Yaman, or the southern or Yemenite Arabs, and the Qais, or northern Arabs. Or in essence, these are the descendants of Yoktan, the south, versus the descendants of Yishmael in the north. There was a time before the Common Era that the Arabs produced civilizations of note. Not great civilizations, but there were small, noteworthy areas that were controlled by Arabs. The magnificent architecture of the city of Petra, produced by the Nabataeans, which were the Arabs of southern Palestine, bear witness to that civilization. Josephus extensively records the role the Nabataeans played during the time of the Maccabee and Herodian kings. In southern Arabia, ruins exist of a civilization that flourished 1,000 years before Muhammad. They left massive buildings, extensive irrigation works, and a wealth of inscriptions written in a language distinct from Arabic with its own alphabet. Afterwards, in the 3rd century of the Common Era, Palmyra, in the Syrian desert, was the capital of a small Arab empire that stretched from the Red Sea to southern Turkey. The beautiful ruins of that city still stand amidst the sand. But by and large, these are mere footnotes in history. The significant history of Arabia only begins with Muhammad, which reminds me of a very cute story. The comedian Milton Berle once visited Israel after it was a state, and he was taken by his Israeli guide to the tomb of the unknown Israeli soldier. So he's looking at the tomb, and he's looking at the inscription, and it says Hyman Goldfarb Furrier. Turns to his Israeli guide and says, "What do you mean he's the unknown Israeli soldier? He has a name. It's Hyman Goldfarb." So the Israeli guide patiently explained to Mr. Berle that as a furrier, Mr. Goldfarb was very well known. But as a soldier, he was virtually unknown. That's the unknown Israeli soldier. In the same sense, the Arabs were known, but they were virtually unknown. But before we go into the life of Muhammad, we must first go into the life of Muhammad's most illustrious forebears, Avraham and Yishmael. As you're well familiar, the story that Abraham had already been some 10 years in Israel, in Palestine. He hadn't had a child from his wife, Sarah. Sarah suggested that he take another wife. He take Sarah's maidservant, Hagar, as a concubine. When Hagar became pregnant, for the first pregnancy, she felt that she shouldn't be treated as a maidservant any longer, but really as a wife. She started berating Sarah. "You see, God favors me, I become pregnant, and somehow you are shunted aside." This caused much grief for Sarah, and she felt that by law she was still her maidservant. And again, with Avraham's permission, she started bearing down on Hagar. Hagar couldn't take it. She ran away to the wilderness. There an angel, or three angels, appeared unto her and assured her and told her to go back, and she had miscarried. She was going to have another child, and that child would be Yishmael. But it was a prophecy not only of a bracha, of a blessing, she would have a child, but it was a certain type of a child. And as we see, and this is the quotation here in the bottom of page 1, paragraph A, "And he shall be a wild man," para odom. Rabbi Yochanan and Shimon ben Lakish had the following explanation. What is meant by a wild man? It isn't just merely going to have a child, but a wild man. Rabbi Yochanan said this means although everyone else is raised in populated areas, Yishmael will be raised in the desert. As you all know, desert life is difficult. In fact, the Talmud in Erevin 55b in Unhamud Beis describes the life of a nomad as being a non-life. Chayehem einum chayim. There were Jews. There were Jewish, we're going to speak of further on. There were actually Jewish tribes of nomads. But their life is no life. In fact, the Talmud comments, it's akin to living in a Beis HaKvoros, living permanently in a cemetery because of the difficulty and you're cut off from normative society. The chief diet of the Bedouin consists of dates and milk, with occasional camel meat. Fermented, the date gives him his favorite beverage. It's a form of beer. Its crushed pits provide the everyday meal of his camel. His clothing consists of a long shirt with a sash and a flowing upper garment. His head is covered with a shawl held by a cord. Pants are not worn, and sandals or shoes are rare. His chief companion is the camel. Without it, desert life would be inconceivable. Not only does it function as a means of transportation, but the camel provides for most of his needs. He drinks its milk instead of water, which he spares for his livestock. He feasts on its flesh, recovers himself with its skin. He makes his tent from its hair. Its dung he uses as fuel, and its urine as a shampoo and a protection against insect bites. The camel is also the chief medium of exchange. The dowry of a bride, the profit of gambling, the wealth of a sheik are all computed in terms of camels. The Arabic language is said to have about 1,000 names for the camel, in its numerous varieties, breeds, condition, and stages of growth. That number is only rivaled by the synonyms used for the sword, which brings us to the next portion of the Medrash. Rav Shimon ben Lokesh said that Pera Odom refers not by the fact that he goes and lives in the desert, but he is a wild person. And it really connects with the other prophecy, as we see. Shimon looks, although other nations plunder money, he will plunder souls. His hand will be against every man, and every man's hand will be against him. In Bedouin life, the raid, or the Gehazwa, was a national institution. According to the rules of the game, and the Bedouins gave the Gehazwa, the raid, the status of being the national pastime, like baseball for us, I guess. No blood should be shed except in cases of extreme necessity. I guess that came up very often. But nonetheless, there were many cases of extreme necessity. An early Arab poet gave expression to the guiding principle of such light, of life, in two verses. That quote says, "Our business is to make raids on the enemy, on our neighbor, and on our brother in case we find none to raid but a brother." Now, it's the raid Iberalis. In other words, the best one is to have against enemy. If you can't, you have to do it against somebody. Muhammad tried to curb the practice, giving the Arabs a sense of solidarity. They're united, in a sense, as one Arabic nation. But it really did not help that much. The means of travel of choice in these raids is not the camel, but the horse. And hence, the very important role that the Arabian horse plays in their culture. Another form of bloodshed, because we're defining now the prophecy of Yishmael as the shedder of blood, is associated with revenge. Every tent represents a family. Members of one encampment represent a clan. Clans stick together. The senior member of the clan is the sheikh, the sheikh, or chief. So you wonder what an Arab sheikh is. That's a leader of a clan of Arabs. A number of kindred clans grouped together make a tribe. If a member of one clan kills a member of another clan, a vendetta is established. Any fellow clan member may have to pay for the crime with his blood. It's like the mafia a little bit. Blood calls for blood. A blood feud may last up to 40 years until it's finally settled. Lacking a sense of nationality, the clan and tribal units serve the Bedouin as the object of his unconditional loyalty. The clan and tribe in turn protected him. No worse a calamity could befall a Bedouin than the loss of his tribal affiliation. For without the protection of one's tribe, he is practically helpless. Islam made good use of the tribal system, dividing the Arab armies and settling the conquered lands according to tribal lines. So it gave them all the Arabs in one area, whether it be in Tunisia or Egypt or Iran. It gave them a sense of solidarity, and they didn't fight the other ones because they only settled the Khoevims, as the relatives were all settled in one area. New converts to Islam, because by and large when they came and conquered an area, they converted the populace, became in a sense adopted by the clan that they chose. Not actually true members of the clan, the status of the convert or the mawali was as a client or protege. In another lecture, we're going to speak again about the problems that the Arabs had with the mawalis, because it's difficult for any people who share the same religion and language and culture as these converts did, because they became absorbed and began to speak Arabic and practice Islam, at the same time to be treated as second-rate citizens. The other thing which we're going to discuss at the end of the lecture is the fact that even though Muhammad developed a system of kashrus, those Arabs had to slaughter their meat, they're forbidden to eat pork, understand? The original Arabs, though, ate animals, just ate carrion. In fact, this is the last citation here on the first page. This says Yodabakol Viyad Kolbo, and this his hand is in everything, and the hand of everything is in him, and as the idea that he's a fighter is also the word kolbo is similar to the word kalbo, his dog. And there's a hint, a remez, there's a certain similarity between the ancient Arab and a dog. It says just as the dogs eat carrion, so too will the Arab. And this is, again, the idea of being wild, untamed. There's an animal streak in Yishmael and his descendants. And this is something that Muhammad eventually curbed. Another very distinctive aspect of the Arabs, even before Muhammad, was circumcision. As you see in the first... So it's the first citation from the Medrash. Not only was Yishmael circumcised at the age of 13, he was very proud of it, and in fact taunted his brother Yitzchak for the fact that he as an adult went through circumcision, whereas Yitzchak only did it as an infant. The practice of circumcision amongst Arabs is cited in the Talmud. Again, these are pagan Arabs, and yet they still practice circumcision. And it would seem to be a practice which came down from Yishmael. There's another aspect of them, and this really centers around the very important chapter of Yishmael's life. Again, we dealt with two chapters so far: his birth and the prophecy of his birth and what kind of a person he's eventually going to turn out to be. We discussed the circumcision. We're discussing now the thing that he was thrown out of the house. Sora saw there was something wrong with this child. She did not want Yishmael to be in the same house as her son Yitzchak, Isaac. What did she see? And here we have on page 2, we quote the Medrash in paragraph C, the various opinions as to what she saw. According to one opinion, can you see the inside? It was because of his immorality. And again, the idea of immorality is something which is common, at least in the time of the Talmud, to the Arabs. It discusses about 10 cobs, and this is the of immorality sent into the world, 9 were taken by Arabia. And perhaps as a protection against this, and as a means of dealing with this problem, of this superactive libido. We find in the last citation here on page 2, again another quote from the Talmud. Arabian women in the time of the Talmud went out veiled, just as they do today in Iran, or in Saudi Arabia, where they just go totally veiled except for their eyes. So too it was in ancient times. And in all probability, again, this was a compensation for their, for the fact of this, this high level of immorality that had to be, that had to be dealt with. But we find at least one citation, again, of one interpretation of what Sora saw wrong in Yishmael was this immorality, and she didn't want her son to be touched by it. Another explanation, let me see, here is on page 3 from the Medrash, is Rabbi Shmuel's explanation that refers, she saw idolatry. And again, this is the original Arabs before Muhammad were all pagans. When Muhammad shattered the idols of the Kaaba, which we're going to discuss soon, the most holy place in Mecca, there were 360 he had to shatter. There's 360 different gods. So it wasn't that there was just one or two, or there was a plethora of gods. The chief god, though, in pre-Islamic Arabia, was the moon god. But I guess the moon god had a lot of competition. Another opinion yet saw the failing of Yishmael, that Sora felt that she had to throw him out of the house, was murder. Shvichas Domim, which is again something that we cited before, bloodshed was very common to the Arabian culture. And in fact, according to this interpretation, Yishmael was really trying to kill Yitzchak. He was shooting, he was shooting arrows. Hopefully, it was Baruch Hashem, he missed. And when he was confronted, he was just said, "I was just kidding, just playing." Yet another interpretation, this is the interpretation of Rabbi Shimon, is the problem was not his immorality or his idolatry or his natural tendency to kill. It could be at that point it didn't come out yet. It was simply the sibling rivalry. It was the sense that he felt he is the true heir of Abraham and Yitzchak is not. And it was for this reason, and this we have on paragraph F on page 3, he was thrown out. And this is something which was... there's one minor incident which is described, alluded to in the Talmud, and Rashi quotes in the commentary, says on the Torah of Yishmael, and in the incident after he was thrown out, that there was when the Jews were exiled from Israel in the first time by Nebuchadnezzar, they passed by the Arabs, and the Arabs gave them salted fish. Without giving them water, says, and they were suffering from dehydration. There was a hatred that the Arabs had to Jews, but the idea of rivalry and the idea of that who is the rightful heir of Abraham is something that came out later on in history, and just fascinating how the foundations were laid so early. Another aspect of Yishmael's makeup is prayer. And we learn a very important principle of prayer from Yishmael's prayer. On top of page 4, I'm going to quote another quotation from the Medrash. The power of prayer of someone who is sick and need of prayer is the most powerful. There's a question, should you pray or have somebody else pray for you? If you're in the right state of mind, you should pray better for yourself.
You know, there's a very cute story, just to digress, there's a very cute Chassidish Maisa, a very cute Chassidic story about prayer. There was in one of the great dynasties, Hasidic dynasty, was the dynasty of Chernobyl, of the Twersky family. I'm familiar with Dr. Twersky is from that family. There was the first of the line was Reb Nochum Chernobyler. He was a contemporary of the Baal Shem Tov. His son was Reb Mordechai, Reb Motel Chernobyler. Reb Motel had some 7 or 8 children. One of them was Reb David Tolner, the Tolner Rebbe. And one, he had a brother, this is Yochanan, I think the story was, another brother. Reb David Tolner had a very large following. His brother did not. And one day, the brother came to his more popular sibling, Reb David, and he asked him, "What's the secret of your success? How is it that people like stream to you?" He says, "Almost no one comes to me." So he says, "I'll tell you what the secret is. I came to a larger area originally, and you settled in a smaller area. To begin with, I really never had much time for all the people that came to me. I couldn't hear their whole story. There wasn't a complete catharsis. So when people would come to me and tell me their story, and I would pray for everyone, but after they left, they felt, you know, if I didn't tell the whole story to the Rebbe, if I told him only this detail or the other detail, then he would really know what my plight is. So the people feel, you know what? I'll have to pray for myself. I can't just rely on the Rebbe. So they pray, and Hashem answers their prayers. And they think, of course, that the one who's being answered is the Rebbe. So my fame spreads, and the people, I can't say, they line up, you know, like they line up for hours and hours and hours, thinking that somehow my prayers are effective. And of course, the truth is, it's their own. You, on the other hand, started off in a small area. People who came to you, you give them all the time in the world. When they leave, they feel, I told the Rebbe everything. He says, they don't bother praying for themselves because the Rebbe is going to do the job. And, you know, how do I compare? How does a second party compare to the person himself? And, of course, they're not answered. He says, you get no fame. So the secret really is the fame is the people, by me, that really the people pray on their own, and that's where they answer, and I get the credit. And that really is this is what the Medrash is saying. The most powerful thing you can do is really pray for yourself. And it was his prayer that was listened to. And even though they saw in the future that his children would turn out bad, but he at that point was a righteous person, and Hashem heard his prayers. And this is a quotation of the Medrash. As we're going to see today, Arabs pray 5 times a day. And they come together every Friday to pray. Prayer is very big amongst the Arabs. Prayer, we learn prayer from Yishmael. In fact, the word Yishmael is Yishmael, Hashem has heard the prayer. This is the prayer of the mother. Now we have the prayer of the person himself. After he was thrown out, Avraham still had feelings for his son. It's a fascinating story, which is recorded both in the Medrash Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer and in Arab sources. In all probability, the Arab sources borrowed from the Jews. Some of the most foremost of the Arab early writers were converted Jews. They were familiar with the stories, with the Midrashim, and they enriched Arab heritage. This is one of those stories. You can look at it yourself in the detail. I'm just going to summarize this for you. This is on page 4. When Yishmael was sent out, his mother went. He needed to get married, and they took from the daughters of Moab. This is relatives of Avram. This is they took from that family. Some years later, some 3 years later, after they had gotten married, Avram went to see Yishmael. He wanted to see what happened with his son. He promised his wife Sora, though, he wouldn't get off the camel. You just go, say hello, and go back. I don't want you to have anything to do with him. And that was the compromise. So he went. He took the long trip. He was well over 100 at that point. He says, took the trip, went to where Yishmael was. Yishmael was not home. The wife was home. And he asked the wife, says, you know, I'm thirsty. He says, I'm hungry. And she says, well, I'm sorry, I don't have anything to give you. Should I gave in the office already? And I says, I have nothing to give you. So he told her, says in these words, when Yishmael returns, tell him the following. Says that an old man is, he told him, says, the son of a wise man is partially wise. Tell him that statement. As he should know that he should get this was a hint that there's a wisdom inherent in him. He should pick up the hint. Tell him the old man from the land of Canaan came to see you. He said the threshold of the house is not good for you. Your door entrance is no good. When Yishmael returned, Avram had left. Yishmael returned, and she told him the message. He understood. But the idea that the threshold is no good, he divorced his wife. This is the Hagar, this is the thing Hagar got, as it says in the Torah, got a wife for Yishmael from the land of Egypt. And this was Patim or Fatima. Again, 3 years passed from that marriage. Avraham comes. Again, he promises his wife, sorry, he's not going to get off the camel, he's just going to speak. His mazel is, Yishmael's not home again. But he asked the wife again for water and bread. She comes out and she takes care of him. Yishmael says, went and says, Avram went and prayed before Hashem, and he gave this blessing that the wife heard. He says, the house of Yishmael should be full of many good things, all kinds of blessings. And this is what the And he left. She told the wife, Fatima told her husband Yishmael the story, and she understood, says, that the old man was Avram. He had come, and he knew that the father still loved him. That's the end of the story. This is the Medrash. We know that hospitality, that Hachnosis Orachim, was very much a part of Avram's life. He wanted to make sure that it should be part of his son's Yishmael's life. And to this day, hospitality, along with bravery, it's called Hamasa in Arabic, manliness, Moruah, Diyafa ranks as one of the greatest of all Arab virtues. To refuse a guest hospitality, especially in the harsh environs of Arabia, or after accepting him, to harm him in any way is considered a cardinal offense. In addition to the three above mentioned virtues of bravery and manliness and hospitality, there's the virtue of generosity, karam, generosity above and beyond the call of duty, and sharaf, the virtue of honor or avoiding dishonor or humiliation. Again, which is something we're going to touch upon later in the lecture. All these virtues predate Islam, but to this day they are still prized in the Arabic culture. So these five virtues of bravery, manliness, hospitality, generosity, and sharaf, this is having honor or avoiding dishonor. The description of Arabic life we've just covered is from the Jahiliya. This literally means the time of ignorance, the pre-Islamic era. Although much of the pre-Islam nature of Arab life has not changed to this day, a new and radical chapter in the history of Arabia began with the birth of Muhammad in the year 570. Muhammad was born into the clan of the Hashim, a poor branch of the noble and powerful tribe of the Quraysh, the custodians of the Kaaba shrine in Mecca. In other words, the tribe that settled around Mecca was exclusively the Quraysh tribe. And we said every tribe is made up of various clans. Muhammad's clan was the clan of Hashim. In all of Arabia, this Kaaba shrine was the holiest area in all of Arabia. Kaaba is a cubical building, and that's what the word Kaaba means in Arabic, is square. This building houses a large black stone, probably of meteoric origin, which was venerated by the Arabs having some spiritual power. At the time of Muhammad's birth, it served as a pagan sanctuary. As we said, that there were 360 idols around the Kaaba shrine. The name Muhammad means highly praised in Arabic. His father, Abd Allah, or the servant of Allah, died before he was born. His mother, Amina, or the faithful one, died when he was only 6. He was raised by his uncle, Abu Talib, the head of the Hashim clan. This name, by the way, reappears in modern history. The country of Jordan is called the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. King Hussein is a descendant of Muhammad and the Hashemite clan. When Muhammad was 25 years old, he found employ with a wealthy widow, Khadija, who was 15 years his senior. Soon after, they were married. With Khadija, he had 2 sons who died young and 4 daughters. One of the daughters was Fatima. If you remember, we mentioned that name before. Fatima was the wife of Yishmael, who from that came out the whole, and there's all the descendants of Yishmael. Muhammad's daughter later acquired special prominence as the wife of Muhammad's cousin Ali, who became the 4th Khalif, the caliph, the recognized leader of Islam. In the year 610, when Muhammad was 40, while in a cave on Mount Hira, outside Mecca, he claimed that he received a vision. He was supposedly called on to preach the message entrusted to him by Allah. Even in the pagan days of Arabia, the name of the god Allah was known. Muhammad's father's name was Abd Allah, the servant of Allah. Allah was the creator, the supreme provider, the God to be invoked in times of the greatest peril. But throughout the Jahiliya, Allah was considered to be merely one of many gods that control the fate of man. The message of Muhammad was, La ilaha illallah. There is no God but Allah. There are not many gods, but one God, Allah, the creator of the universe. His message was, not only did he create the universe, but he will judge mankind on the final judgment day. The righteous will receive splendid rewards in paradise, and the sins terrible punishment in hell. It was a very Jewish message, and it's evident that Muhammad was exposed in some manner to the teachings of the Torah by coming into contact with Jews. It's just interesting, if you turn to page 5, here, top of page 5, is one of the very interesting things about Yishmael himself. Despite we've discussed the different aspects of his personality, as hinted at in the Midrashim, the fact is he's this wild man, he's this raider, he's the one who's immoral, who worships idols, who kills, and yet Yishmael did tshuva. On the top of page 5, reading the Gemara in Bava Basra, Tazayin Amud Beis, 16b, that Yishmael eventually repented. And it's interesting, again, that pattern of change we find and the descendants of Yishmael. From the time of his earliest vision, Muhammad claimed from that time on to receive prophecy on a constant basis through the angel Gabriel, or as it known is in Arabic, Jibril. His new religion was called Islam, submission to Allah. The message from Allah, however, was not well received amongst the tribe of Quraysh, the citizens of Mecca. As long as Muhammad's uncle Abu Talib was alive, Muhammad was protected by the Hashim, because his uncle was the head, was the sheikh, was the leader of the Hashim. But after the death of Abu Talib in 619, his successor refused to continue to protect him. At that time, he sustained another terrible loss with the death of his wife and supporter, Khadija. During the time when he preached in Mecca, his followers were severely persecuted. Almost 100 of his followers and their families were forced to flee to Ethiopia, and he himself was forced to curtail his preaching. When he received an invitation by a delegation of some 75 men from Medina, his mother's maiden city, which is located some 300 miles north of Mecca, Muhammad and about 200 of his followers decided to move to Medina. In the year 622, they made their move, or Hijra, northward. That year marks the beginning of the Muslim calendar. In Medina, Muhammad became not only a prophet, but a statesman and military leader as well. Soon after his arrival, an organized Muslim community gradually came into existence under his leadership. 2 years later, Muhammad started a war against Mecca. Mecca, besides being a holy city, this was a holy pagan city, but was at that time the leading commercial center of Arabia. Just as in antiquity, the descendants of Yishmael were, as we know, as the descendants of Yishmael in antiquity were caravan traders. That's the story of Yosef. That Joseph was sold by his brothers to the descendants of Yishmael. This is the Ishmaelim, the caravan drivers who had this trade. This is through this from Syria to Egypt. They had trade. This was a caravan from Syria that was going down to Mecca, to Arabia. This caravan was well defended, but Muhammad's 300 Muslims were able to defeat a force of 1,000 Meccans. This was his first taste of blood. This is the first Muslim victory. Although the Meccans retaliated the next year and even managed to wound Muhammad, their victory had little effect against Muhammad and his followers. In 627, a force of 10,000 Meccans unsuccessfully besieged Medina. The next year, Muhammad led a body of 1,400 Muslims to the city of his birth, Mecca, and negotiated a pact with the Quraysh to cease all hostilities. Only a short year later, though, in 629, the armistice was broken and hostilities were renewed. Finally, at the end of January of 630, Muhammad entered Mecca at the head of a victorious army. The Meccans surrendered, and Muhammad offered them a general amnesty if they accepted Islam. Entering the great sanctuary of Mecca, the Kaaba, Muhammad smashed its hundreds of idols, as he said, there are 360 idols, and declared, quote, "Truth has come and falsehood has vanished," end quote. The Kaaba was now dedicated as Islam's holiest shrine. By the way, Muslims look at the temporary peace that Muhammad made with the Quraysh in Mecca in 628 as a tactical ploy to lull them into a false sense of security and to eventually gain victory. Recently, Yasser Arafat, speaking to an Arab audience about the present political situation, compared the peace process and his truce with the Israelis to the truce that Muhammad made with the Quraysh in 628. How interesting. During the period Muhammad was in Medina, Islam took a much more Arab and less of a Jewish form. Originally, the day of rest for Muhammad meant Saturday or Shabbos. And when he and his followers prayed, it was towards Jerusalem. One of his first prophecies in Medina was the commandment to fast from sunset to sunset on the 10th of the first month of the year, which corresponds to Yom Kippur. By the second year of the Hijra, his immigration to Medina, Islam moved away from Judaism. Friday, not Shabbos, became the Muslim day of rest. The Kaaba of Mecca now became the direction of Muslim prayers, not Jerusalem. And instead of fasting on the 10th of the first month, the whole 9th month of Ramadan was designated as a time of fasting. Ramadan, by the way, was the month where Muhammad purportedly had his first vision. So it was that month is the month of fasting. It seems that Muhammad's early attempts at converting the Jews were strongly rebuffed. A great portion of the population of the people of Medina were Jews. And scholars assume that Muhammad felt that if he would make this religion Jewish enough, would be able to attract these Jewish followers. He was greatly disappointed. And in the writings that you see clearly a distinction in the early writings when he was in Mecca before he came to Medina, and afterwards when he was firmly planted in Medina and he saw that the Jews would not be willing to accept his faith. In Mecca, Muhammad described the Jews as God's chosen people who were admitted to his covenant and assured of paradise. In Medina, they were criticized as being contentious, as violating the Torah, and as falsifying and altering Scripture. The stories that of Scripture that Muhammad as recorded in the Quran, seems to be a garbled version of the original stories of the Torah. He was illiterate, Muhammad. He heard things secondhand from Arabs, from Jews, you know, Arabic Jews who were nomadic Jews, who in all probably were not Talmidei Chachamim, were not scholars themselves. They had some Jewish learning, but not much. And the stories, as they came into being in the Quran, were different from that of the Torah. And of course, he claimed the problem was the Jews, and not himself, that they had falsified the original story. Because of all of this, the Jews were cursed by God, punished and doomed to humiliation on this earth, and destined to burn in hell after they die. Which gives you a sense of how Arabs view Jews. It's very similar to how Christians view Jews. It's a funny thing. And what's even funnier is the Jews don't view these people the same way. You know, which is fascinating. The Jews have a very positive view on, you know, at least on people that live a righteous life. You know, those people who are not Rishoyim people. They have a very positive view of the Hasidim Masoilim. I guess the same is not said for the others towards the Jews. His attitude towards Jews was not merely academic. In Medina, there were three Jewish clans. In the year 627, in retaliation for their perceived support of the Meccans in their siege of Medina, and after their refusal to convert to Islam, he killed out the entire adult male population of the Jewish clan of the Banu Qurayza, 600 males, and sold the women and children into slavery. The remaining two clans were banished from Medina. By the way, there was not only religious and political motivation involved. Medina, unlike Mecca, was an agricultural area. The Jews were owners of large date plantations. And as we said, dates was a mainstay for the Arabs. We began the class. They fed themselves and they fed their animals. After the defeat and banishment, their date plantation became the possession of the landless followers of Muhammad who had emigrated with him from Mecca. So it was also a means of dealing with high unemployment, which again, this means has been employed by many, many others throughout history. 2 years later, in 629, Muhammad led a force against Khaybar, an oasis approximately 75 miles north of Medina, populated solely by Jews. This time he was a bit more generous. He let them stay on the land with freedom to practice their religion. The price they had to pay, though, was they had to give Muhammad half of their annual harvest of dates. Now, this is even worse than the IRS. After his power was consolidated, however, he seems to have been more conciliatory. In the year following the conquest of Mecca, delegations were sent him from throughout Arabia, even as far as Yemen and Oman. These pagan Arabs all agreed to accept Islam. That same year, Muhammad concluded treaties with the Christian chief of Al-Aqaba and the Jewish tribes in the oasis of Makna, Adru, and Jarba to the south. Aqaba is the Gulf of Aqaba. This is the north. The native Jews and Christians were taken under the protection of the newly arising Islamic community in consideration of a payment, later called jizya, which included land and head tax. This treaty served as a precedent for Muhammad's successors in dealing with the Jews. The Jews, as well as Christians, were not required to convert to Islam. They were the people of the book. They were required, however, to accept secondary but protected status for a price, the jizya. They were called the himis, the protected ones. Pagans, on the other hand, were required to accept Islam on penalty of death or slavery. Look on page 5 of your handout. And again, we'll just quote two passages from the Quran. First one is, "And humiliation and wretchedness were stamped upon them and were visited with wrath from God." The fact is, the chapters are not grouped chronologically in the Quran. And this early chapters actually was from the period of Medina. And it continues on, "Fight those to whom scriptures were given, who believe not in Allah nor the last day, and forbid not that which Allah hath forbidden by his messenger Muhammad, and follow not the religion of truth. But fight them until they pay the tribute, the jizya, readily, being brought low." He says, if they pay and accept inferior status, then we can live with them. And that principle became the principle of dealing with the Jews. But it was a two-way street. But by the fact that they did pay this tax, the Arabs felt beholden to them that they had to protect them. One of the wealthiest and most powerful Jews in the 10th century, in the end of the 9th century, beginning of the 10th century, was a Jew by the name of Natira. He is a person that in the class that Mr. Shem will be giving in March, we'll speak of in greater detail. This Natira saved the life. I mean, it was a story that said about him that he was very favored by the caliph. And as a sign of appreciation, he wanted to free him, the Jewish people, from the jizya. He wanted to lift them up. They don't have to pay this terrible tax. And he convinced the caliph not to do so. Don't take away the jizya. And he says, this is the quote here, "By the payment of jizya, the Jews became Dahimi's protected subjects. Were their tax to be abolished, Jewish blood would be shed freely." As then the Arabs would feel, and they feel a moral obligation because they look at them as guests. And it's a cardinal sin to harm a guest. But if they would look at them just as another clan, they fight against other clans. And they would have the hatred they would have for the Jews would come out. So he says, we would rather have this payment and the moral obligation they feel because of this. This is a fascinating one. But the idea um, of this Dahimi status increased after the time of Muhammad. The first one to pass additional laws, not just to, they have to be taxed, but to be treated with inferiority, was the caliph Umar II, who ruled between 717 and 720. He demanded that Jews and Christians wear special hats and coats so as to make them easily distinguishable from Muslims. They were not allowed to use a saddle while riding, nor they're allowed to own Muslim slaves. Many of these prohibitions are very similar to the prohibitions that the Church instituted against the Jews, which we touched upon in the last lecture. And it's as scholars maintain that perhaps that he used that as a model. He was aware of it, and after it was the Byzantine Empire was next door to the Arab Empire. He forbade the building of new synagogues or churches, which again we had discussed last time. This is Theodosius's decree, which basically was kept through all of Christendom to prevent Jews from building new synagogues. He also disqualified them from holding public office. Although Umar's legislation fell into disuse after his death, it was eventually reinstated and expanded throughout much of the Muslim world. In some places, like in Yemen, Umar's discriminatory legislation was greatly expanded upon. In the 14th century, the entire Muslim discriminatory legislation was collected into a document and called the Covenant, the Shurut of Umar. And this became the guideline of the Arab of how to deal with Jews. On the whole, though, despite all of these restrictive legislations, that there was a freedom of religion. There were exceptions, and these exceptions, Mir Sashem, will go through, you know, as we throughout the history lecture. But the Jews were generally protected and were free to practice the Torah as a general rule. And on the whole, the lot of Jews in Muslim countries was less precarious than that of Jews who lived under Christian rule. I'd like to quote something to you, where he says, this is in the bottom, this is the last quote on page 5. Because the Jews, for so many centuries, had the status of Dahimi, as a second-class citizen, Jews were not part of the army, Jews didn't fight, Jews were humiliated, they're barely tolerated. The Arabs had a very difficult time dealing with Jews who created a new state. This is, you know, in Palestine, in the middle of the world of Arabia, of the Muslim world. Psychologically, it was devastating. Historians claim that it's for this reason that even though the Arabs vastly outnumbered the Jews who were in Israel, especially when in 1947, and even though they actually sent much larger forces than the Jews had, and much more well-armed forces than the Jews, the Israelis, had, but they could have mustered a force 10 times or 100 times as great. I mean, they have tremendous population. But the reason they didn't, because they felt it's nothing, they're only Dahimis. And it was all part of their rhetoric. I mean, these people, you know, have the chutzpah, you know, have to make an independent state. We'll just wipe them off, we'll send them to the sea. And the fact that they were able to defend themselves was a tremendous psychological shock and a humiliation to the Arabs. Because how could these Dahimis, these second-class human beings, defeat the Arabs? So not only did they not muster a force that they could have, because their population was amazing. I mean, how many Arabs there were. And yet, the Jews were greatly outnumbered, but nowhere near what they could have been. But it was just totally underestimated. They thought they'd come to a quick victory. So not only is the reason that they lost, but how, because they took it so terribly. And again, when they lost in 68, again, it was a terrible humiliation, because had they lost to Russia or the United States or to Turkey or to some other country that they view as an equal, they lost in battle. But the fact is, they lost to Jews, again, giving all the history and how they dealt with the Jews, was a tremendous psychological trauma to them. And I quote here, there was a conference, an Islamic conference that was held shortly after the Six-Day War. This is a year or so after the Six-Day War. This is in 68. And they were, just as we ponder the thing, how we lost Vietnam, the Arabs came together and says, how did we lose this war? And here I'd like to quote this to you. And this is a speech given by Sheikh Nadim al-Jassir, a Lebanese member of the Islamic Research Academy, at the fourth conference of the Academy of Islamic Research. And it sounds like a Musar Shmuz here. It sounds like something that a rabbi could give. Or the prophets of old gave. When the Muslims neglected compliance with these Islamic principles, they became analogous to the wreckage swept down by a torrent. Other nations united against them, even the weakest, the most submissive among them, like the Jews. Evidently, they couldn't take again that there was a Arabic myth that the Americans helped, you know, the Israelis, because they couldn't. It was impossible for them to do it without Allied help. So that's why it's the other nations. I mean, it was really just the Israelis. But again, it's the most submissive and weakest, unlike the Jews. Islamic tradition never implies any possible outbreak of contest between Muslims and the dispersed bands of Jews, living as the Himis, or people of the covenant. This is, we've referred to here, the covenant of Umar, under Muslim rule. It was unprecedented, because fighting in such powerless and scattered band of people was not so significant an issue as requiring an announcement of glad tidings to Muslims by the Prophet, peace be upon him. Evidently, they attribute prophecies of great Arabic victories. There was no prophecy of victory against the Jews, because there's no great war against the Jews. They're dahimis. They're non-beings. And of course, understand in this light, it's easier to understand the Arabic mind of the humiliation. And it's for this reason it was impossible for the Arabs to have a peace process, or to have any truce with the Jews, because it's an admission of defeat. In 1973, when Anwar Sadat surprised the world and surprised the Israelis, and at least the first few days of fighting was able to successfully drive the Israelis out before the Israelis themselves launched a counterattack, that victory gave the Arabs enough dignity that they could now go down, sit down together with the Israelis to sue for peace. And it was only after that victory that Anwar Sadat came to Camp David and could deal with some sort of a peace. Because the Arabs viewed that first few days as a victory. It's amazing. I mean, it's a defeat. And they have a whole, as I understand, there's a whole monument in Egypt dedicated to this great victory. Because unless they saw them as victorious, it would be just a humiliation to deal with, in other words, to be inferior to the inferiors. It was only after that victory could they have the sense of the sharaf, this idea of dignity, which is, we were speaking about the five basic principles that guide Arabic culture, that they had this sense of dignity after these first few days, that they could now Now they could sit down as victorious warriors. It says, and now sit down to deal with the aftermath of the war. It's amazing. I mean, it's a totally different mentality, but if one doesn't understand the mentality, one can't begin to understand at least the dynamics of what's happening there. I'd just like to conclude with this last few minutes of what happened politically and militarily after the death of Muhammad. After Muhammad's death in 632, his kinsman and father-in-law, Abu Bakr, became caliph or successor to Muhammad. Abu Bakr was the father of Aisha, who at that time was Muhammad's favorite wife. After further consolidating his hold on Arabia, he began to expand Islam by launching a campaign against Syria and Palestine. His successor, Umar I, continued his conquests. By the year 637, Umar had liberated all of Syria and Palestine from Byzantine control. Mesopotamia was overrun in 639, Persia fell in 641, and Egypt in 642. In a decade after his death, all of the Middle East except for Anatolia, southern Turkey, was conquered by the followers of Muhammad. And their conquest was an act of salvation for the Jews. As we study, we covered last lecture about how the Jews were discriminated against. The Jews were not allowed to enter Jerusalem. The Byzantine Empire did not allow the Jews, the Romans before them and the Byzantines after them, did not allow the Jews to enter Jerusalem. We discussed at the end of the last lecture about the legislation which was originally initiated by Justinian to curb Jewish practice and Jewish study. This all came to an end. When the Arabs came, the Jews were liberated. And when the Arabs defeated the Persian Zoroastrians, that era of persecution, which we discussed the last lecture of last year, and the Kufas of the Rabbonin Savaroy, where in those last years, before the victory, the Arab victory, life was very difficult for Jews in Persia. Again, it came to an end. The Jews view the Arabs as their saviors. In a sense, they were. As the Rambam points out at the end of the uncensored version of his Mishneh Torah, on the whole, Islam was a boon for the world. It gave much of the world the rich legacy of the Torah in a form that was palatable to the pagan world. With one verse of the Quran, Muhammad outlawed gambling and wine, which next to women were the two indulgences dearest to the Arabs' heart. Arabs who, like dogs, ate carrion were now forbidden to eat meat without ritual slaughter. Pork was disallowed. Prayer and fasting now became part of the life of the Arab. According to Islam, there are four principles of faith. Remember, you heard this all in Machon. The first is belief in Hashem, or as they say, Allah. The second is belief in the prophecy of Muhammad and the Quran, which would be akin to our belief, again, in the Torah, Moshe. Muhammad is considered not only the Rasul, or messenger, but also the Khatim, the chasima, or the final seal of all prophecy. This belief, of course, parallels and substitutes our belief. The third is the belief in angels. And the fourth, the belief in the last day, the day of judgment of all mankind, where the righteous will be rewarded and the sinful punished. And as again, as you see clearly, the parallels between Judaism and Islam. In addition, there are five pillars of worship. One is Shahada. Like we had this week said, Yagar Sadusa. The Sadusa is testimony. Shahada is testimony. It's the expression of faith that every Muslim makes. Lo ilaha illa ilah. Muhammad says, Muhammad Rasulillah. There's no God but Allah, which is basically, there's no God but Hashem. Muhammad is his messenger. A Jew doesn't say this, but the equivalent would be Moshe Rabbeinu was the shliach. These were the first words that, these are the first words that strike the ear of a newborn Muslim infant. You know, this again, this is akin, which is the Gemara says, which predates, of course, Islam, is the first sentence that we teach a child. We say that it says the Torah Tzivalonu Moshe Marosha Kehilas Yaakov. This is a Gemara in Sukkah Mem Beis Amud Aleph, says that the Torah which Moshe commanded is the inheritance of the Jewish people. These are the first words the Jewish child learns. It's interesting, the parallel. This expression of faith of Allah and Muhammad are the last words that are uttered at the grave. This is the call of the muezzin, who calls the faithful to prayer, and the minaret is he calls them through this. This is the formula that he calls them to prayer. So that is the first is idea of faith. That's the first pillar. The second pillar is salat, which is similar to the Aramaic tzilusa, which is prayer. Muhammad, Yishmol, as we said, taught us how to pray. We saw the power of prayer, that an individual's prayer are heard. The word Yishmol is Hashem has heard the prayer. And prayer is very much part of the Muslim's day. Five times a day, he turns to Mecca. It says dawn, midday, mid-afternoon, sunset, and nightfall. In addition, public noon prayers are said on Friday. Third is zakat, or almsgiving. Fourth is like schus again. Fourth is tzom. Soma Siri, Soim Yom Kippur, Soma's fasting, which refers to abstination of food or drink during the daylight hours of the month of Ramadan. The fifth is Hajj, or the pilgrimage to Mecca, which is incumbent on every Muslim who's financially and physically able to make it. And to some, Muslim jihad, or holy war, has been raised to the level of a sixth pillar. It's understood both on the physical level of waging war against the unbelievers, and this is why jihad is, in terms of with Israel, is always this word always comes to play, to make Islam supreme over the world. But it's understood as well on the spiritual level that we would call Milchamas Hayetzer, our own internal struggle for self-perfection, is also called by Muslim thinkers jihad. I'd like to we have a timeline, and I would like just quickly to go over some of the major points of the timeline, which would be a review of this class. In the year 570 or 571 was the birth of Muhammad. Approximately in the year 596 or so, 595, Muhammad marries Khadijah. In 610, Muhammad claims his first revelation. The year 620 was supposed to be the year that Muhammad had this nocturnal journey to Jerusalem. He was supposed to have this out-of-body experience, and he rode on this horse, and he came to Jerusalem, to the Makam HaMikdash. You know, the indentation on the rock is supposed to be, according to Muslim legend, the indentation of the footprint of this horse. This dream, in the earliest versions, does not mention Yerushalayim by name, and was later on built up and expanded to understood that it refers to Yerushalayim, is the Arabic claim to Jerusalem. 622, Muhammad and his followers flee to Medina. This is the Hijra. 624, prayers are set facing Mecca now, not Jerusalem. The Kabbal, the way that the Muslims' face has been changed. 627, Muhammad destroys the Banu Qurayza. This is the Jewish, one of the three Jewish tribes who lived in Medina, who he claims sided with the Meccans in their siege against Medina. They killed all the males and sold the females and children to slavery. The other two tribes were banished, and he took over all of their date plantations. 629, Muhammad defeats the Jews of Khaybar. Again, after he defeated them, he let them stay, but they had to give him half of their proceeds. 630, a victorious Muhammad enters Mecca. In 632, Muhammad is succeeded by Abu Bakr. 634, Abu Bakr is succeeded by Umar. The events, some of them are recorded here, we will discuss in great detail in further classes. I'd just like to summarize. We went through the early story of the Arabs, the pre-Islamic Arabs. We pointed out that many of their features are really alluded to in the early stories of Yishmael, and the different aspects of his makeup is really alluded to in both the immorality and his prayer and hospitality are all alluded to. The fact is he did tshuva at the end, in a sense, seems to be an allusion to the fact is that under Muhammad they threw away their pagan past and embraced monotheism and embraced a religion which is very, very close to Judaism. In fact, it's a certain sense that Islam is much closer to Judaism than Christianity is. The relationships that they had with the Jews, originally Muhammad, just like Martin Luther many years later, hoped to convert the Jews, and in his disappointment lashed out at the Jews. That lashing out is recorded, and Muslims often quoted in dealing with Jews, about the Jews are wretched and are cursed. The policy that he began, giving them a status of being dihimi, brought low, and yet paying taxes, was the policy that was instituted from Arabs from that time on. There were better times and worse times. Umar II is the one who created this, we call the covenant, the shurut of Umar, making their status very similar to the status of how the Byzantine Empire treated the Jews. But on the whole, life under the Arabs was much better than it was under the Christians. Are there any questions? That itself is a miracle, and I think that's, as the Rambam points out, is really, this is the hashgacha that bring the world closer to Mashiach, and is just in the sense that Christianity did as well, that the Christian world was a much more developed spiritual world than the pagan world that preceded it, so too that the Islamic world. But as the Rambam points out, this is only another stage in the development of mankind. In his right life, this again, it's hard to know what the truth is. It seems everything he said baal peh, everything he said by word of mouth, it seemed to have been written down, notes were taken on those who, everything was really studied, everything was studied by heart. But there were notes that were taken on leaves, on leaves of trees, they made notations. And eventually, in the time of Uthman, if you see in the timeline here, Uthman 644, during his reign, it was written down. But it was not written down before then. So one could, and again, it seems that there were different versions, that there were discrepancies. He created the official version. Yeah, the question about is our population and the blessing. The Torah itself says that when the Jews will keep the Torah, they'll be blessed with great numbers, and when they don't, They will become Ma'at Mikol Ha'amim. They will become the smallest of all nations. It's part of the curse, which is the general curse of the Jew, which is the Torah speaks of. At the time of Shlomo Melech, the Jews were Kechol Hayom. They were like the grains of the sea. Tremendous birth rate. They fill the whole land. There are many, many Jews. At the time, if you would just want to give, this is something we cited in a previous lecture, a census was made of the Jews at the time, the end of the reign of King David, David HaMelech. It was how many fighters there were. And it came out fighters, there were 400,000 from the tribe of Yehuda, and from the rest of Jewry, there was 1,100,000. A fighter is someone from the year 20 and up. If you add those two numbers, you get 1.5 million males who are in that military age. If you take that amount of females, you have 1.5 million. You have a nation of 3 million. If you count the children on one end and the older people on the other, you have a nation of about 5 million people. At the time of the destruction of the first temple, when they are counting the captives of Judea, the captives number something like 3,000. I mean, it gives you a sense of what happened. The Jews, there are times, there was a tremendous growth of Jews in Eastern Europe in the 19th century, where they grew from something from, it started from 1 million to something like 8 million. There was some tremendous growth of Jews in one century. And of course, after the Holocaust, it all came to. It's all part of a pattern which the Torah itself predicts. You know, it's an interesting thing about numbers. You know, numbers are a blessing. The Torah itself alludes to the fact that Jews often get maybe because there's so many Jewish actuaries. Jews have problems with numbers. And this is, you're going to look around and see there's so many more goyim. And there's so few Jews. Maybe we should do something to bolster our numbers. We may dilute the quality of Jewry, but Al Capone, we're boasting the quantity. And he says, Loi mimneis, not because you're the most of all nations that I chose you. I chose you because you're the smallest, because you're the most humble. You come from Avram Yitzchak V'Yaakov. He says, I'm looking at quality, not quantity. You know, and that's how the Jews have to look at it. You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go all the way back to. There is a statement of Muhammad that scholars maintain that he meant that they shouldn't come to the Kaaba, you know, and they took it, or at least a time of worship, and they took it to mean they shouldn't come to Mecca at all. But Umar, who came from Abu Bakr, claimed that the Arabia should be free of Jews. At least there should be only one religion in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, in Arabia itself. And it's because of his statement that there are very few Jews in Arabia. Southern Arabia and Yemen had them. It seems even on the south part of Saudi Arabia, up until the, I don't know, the 20th and the 19th century for sure, there were small groups of Jews in that area of southern Arabia that touched Yemen who were jewelers, who were goldsmiths and silversmiths. And they kept them because they knew the trade and they allowed them to be there. But those were, you know, exceptions. Yeah, but there was a, generally they are the Jewish protectors, but since there was this other statement that at least there should be Judenrein, in other words, that Arabia should be free, so they choose to be very frum in certain things. You know, this is one of them. Umar, this is the second one, after Abu Bakr, in other words, after Muhammad died, the caliph was Abu Bakr, and after he died, it was Umar. That Saudi Arabia should not have any Jews. Should not have any other religions. They shouldn't have Christianity, shouldn't have only Islam. And even though they tolerate in other places, but there should be one place that should be the symbol of what what life should be. You know, this is, that's why for that reason they had problems, you know, I guess it complicates it. When the American troops had to come in, you know, in Project, you know, Desert Storm, they had a problem of having Christians. You know, because again, this was not the Tzivui, this is not the command of Umar. So a lot of this history, present day history, you can understand just knowing the roots.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.